Dennis Nielsen was arrested after body parts were found to be blocking drains at the house where he lived. And as the squad car drove him away, he confessed he'd strangled 15 young men. It wasn't just the crimes that were stunning, it was the way he spoke. And a journalist who began corresponding with him 20 years ago and who's waded through thousands of pages in which Nielsen detailed the sickening ways he disposed of his victims is joining us now to talk about his new book. Russ Coffey joins us on the line. Good morning, Russ. Thank you for doing this.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Whoa.
I tried. Nielsen sent a visitor's request, and then a couple of policemen came round to my house, and they decided that they didn't want me to see him. They said it was a security risk, but I think, in truth, they just didn't want the danger, the prospect of Nielsen self-promoting anymore.
Interesting. Let's go back to the beginning with him. He grew up in Aberdeenshire. His upbringing is described as cold and dour. Well, you could say that of a lot of people, but didn't turn them into serial killers. His father, Olaf, was a rather shadowy figure, and his mother, Betty, is described as unemotional from a Puritan background. Not unusual upbringing, or was it, Russ?
Well, it was just after the war. It certainly wasn't unusual for a lot of people, but Nielsen wasn't the same as others. Mm. You know, he says in his own words, you know, I was born different, but it wasn't these differences that later created my destructive behavior, but an utter repudiation of them. Well, how much do we buy that? What is, you know, with people like this, it's, most people agree that it's some degree of nature and some degree of nurture.
Yes.
The thing is, he was different from those around him. It was it's a fishing village, right at the fishing town, right at the very north of Scotland. It's quite a cold and harsh and brutal place. And he was creative and sensitive. I mean, from an early age, he realized he was gay, and he had creative tendencies. So he was different. And somehow the mismatch between him and those around him would have had some impact. Whether or not that caused his behaviour is entirely a different matter.
Yes, he didn't confess his homosexuality to his family, and he tried to hide it from almost everybody. And he also, when he was in the army during the 60s, basically had violent fantasies, it was claimed, that he developed in the army. So let's talk about his murders here. They go back to, I think, December 1978, his first murder.
Yes, correct. Stephen Holmes.
Yeah, 14-year-old, met him in a North London pub, throttled him and drowned him in a bucket. Extraordinary.
Correct.
Extraordinary.
Correct.
And then his MO... Tell us a little bit about that.
That's right. Well, just going back to that first murder, there's something interesting there, because Nielsen would always say that he didn't know why it happened. This is one of the reasons why they developed such a mythology around him, was the way he would talk about these murders as if they baffled him.
Wow.
As much as anyone else. But looking back through his own writing, we see this progression of these fantasies that you talk about in the army leading up to it, and eventually he enacts it. But when it happens, he assumes quite reasonably that there's going to be a knock on the door, and he's going to be arrested. You know, he hasn't committed a crime like this, and it seems, you know, he used to be in the police. He has faith that they might come and find him, but it doesn't happen. So that he takes the body out, and his fantasies involved a lot of role play. So he talked to the corpse. And dressed it and undressed it. It's very bizarre, but this is all part of his internal fantasy world. And then he puts it under the floorboards for months and months and months, still thinking that there might be a knock on the door.
Incredible. It took him nearly a year to go after his next victim, who's probably the luckiest man on the planet, I think, a guy called Andrew Ho.
That's right, and... recently, I had a letter from the detective, who I hadn't spoken to before, who interviewed Andrew Ho, and he filled me in a little bit about that. The commonly accepted story was that the police were a little bit brusque and didn't make Ho feel that because he was a young gay man that they would listen to his story. But this detective said that really wasn't the case. It was to do with his family and his sense of shame. He came from Hong Kong and he just didn't want to pursue it. But Ho had found himself in the flat with Nielsen and Nielsen attacked him, and he managed to escape and he ran out screaming and you know, he went to the police, but he decided not to take it any further.
Wow. And then, of course, it went on and on and on. December 79, a Canadian student was strangled. And, I mean, extraordinary stories. He took Polaroid pictures of that body and claimed that in the next few days he would drag it from under his floorboards and watch TV with the corpse sitting in a chair beside him.
Well, that's right. And, you know, not long after that, he was making dinner for all his colleagues in the job centre, and coming back and playing the records that they'd listened to together. But Nielsen, he had this ability to completely compartmentalise this murderous fantasy world with his other life. So he would go out and he would do other things seemingly normally. There was no great indication to those around him that there was something so deeply disturbed in his life or in his psychology.
Yes, I mean, he worked at the job centre in Denmark Street in the West End of London. They describe him as an unremarkable, introverted man. And even when he took people back to his flat, he would laugh off the conditions of his flat, blaming the smell from the corpses on his dog and spraying air fresheners around the rooms. Extraordinary compartmentalisation.
It is. It's also extraordinary how I've spoken to people who went into his flat, and it would seem that he, I mean, people were less housebound in those days, and he must have done a reasonable job of disguising the smell until the summer came and the heat made things worse. But your point is that he would invite people in, and he just didn't seem to. There was part of his brain that just wasn't registering. You know, was completely cold, that kind of psychopathic part of his brain that was emotionally cold to the danger that he was putting himself in, perhaps in a similar way to how he was emotionally cold when he had somebody in his flat, and that surge of empathy that you or I would feel if there's an animal in pain, you know, people can feel it's a physical force. That seemed to be largely, if not entirely, absent with Nielsen, except when it came to himself.
Had the grisly ordeal of Carl Stotter described to you. He tried to strangle and drown him. He realised he wasn't dead. He resuscitated him and then nursed him in bed for 2 days.
Yeah, poor old Carl never got over that. I went down and saw him towards the end of his life, and he told me in great detail. And initially he thought it was a day, and then he looked at his watch and he realized, hang on, I was there for 2 days. And then he went to the hospital, and Nielsen came up with this fantastical story about how he had got his neck trapped in the zip had come undone, actually from the lining had come undone, so it was loose with the fabric attached off the sleeping bag that he was in, and he said that you got your neck trapped in that, and when you saw the sort of marks, the strong marks around his neck, it was from the metal. But the interesting thing is that Nielsen had mentioned the sleeping bag as soon as Stotter had got into the flat, almost.
Yeah.
This gives the lie to this idea that Nielsen liked to promote, that he just invited people in for company, and then something would take over. He'd be overcome by something, some alien force, and it would sort of make him do these things.
Yes, but he's not a master criminal. In the end, in fact, none of his murders appear to have been that carefully planned as one would expect. And the last one, he continued to kill at his new flat in Muswell Hill. And I apologise to listeners for the gruesomeness of this, but basically he removed the bones, he boiled bones to remove the flesh, which he flushed down the toilet, which of course eventually that blocked the drains. And the residents complained to the landlord, called a plumber, and he discovered human remains. And in fact, Nielsen himself complained to the landlord.
Well, that was, you know, that was, he found himself in a corner, and, and he felt that if he complained, then that would divert attention away from it. Meanwhile, you know, this wasn't crazy thinking. This was somebody who sat down and thought, well, what can I do in this situation?
Yeah.
If I seem as indignant and self-righteous as everyone else, then it might buy me a little bit of time, which it almost did. And then one day, the man from the dyno rod, the plumbing man, came, and he couldn't finish the job off. And Nielsen went down in the middle of the night and started picking stuff out of the drains, thinking, well, maybe I can get that. He even bought a tub of Kentucky Fried Chicken so that when the guy came back the next day, and because he'd seen something down in the drains and he thought that it smelt and looked a bit like flesh, he'd pick up a chicken bone and say, oh, you know, leave it at that. It was just food. It was dog food. It was chicken bones.
Right.
And he would have got away with it.
He didn't get away with it, obviously, as we know, and he pled guilty to the killings and even confessed to three that the police couldn't confirm, although do you think he maybe invented those just to make sure that he was up there with Britain's top serial killers?
Very possibly. One of the psychiatrists at Nielsen's trial said to me later that on reflection he thought that maybe one of the real keys to the man's psychology was this pathological grandiosity. And that grandiosity, you know, when Nielsen was arrested, it seemed very confusing to people that suddenly he couldn't stop confessing and being helpful. But this was you know, in each different circumstance, he needed to elevate himself.
Yeah.
And now he was in the interview room. He wanted to be domineering and telling them that he'd done everything, and it wasn't just the importance of how many people he did it, but his psychological complexity. He was a man he would like them to believe who couldn't understand it, that was driven by emotional and psychological forces greatly superior to those around him.
It's interesting, when his solicitor told him to enter a plea of not guilty for the reason of diminished responsibility, it apparently took many weeks for him to be persuaded to plead not guilty because his own ego couldn't bear the thought that he was diminished in any way at all.
That's absolutely right. And it was only when he then found a way of intellectualizing this, in which the complexity of his psychology wasn't somehow more exceptional than he would otherwise have it if he was diminished. You know, that was the only way in which he could accept. He didn't, you know, he had to be exceptional in some way, and for him to have an exceptionally complex diminished mindset was acceptable to him. But it took him a long time to get there.
Yes. And when in prison, you read that he was campaigning to be allowed to publish what was basically a self-glorifying autobiography. That was in the late 90s. You wrote to him, and he gave you access to a copy of the manuscript that he had smuggled out of jail. So what was that like to read that for the first time?
Well, and a lot of it's just rambling. I'd say two-thirds or thereabouts, it was simply long, boring complaints about prison or descriptions of how amazing he was in prison, all these extracurricular activities he had, and nobody's particularly interested in that. There's one section that is really the kind of essence of it, which was written by Nielsen for a clinical psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
A long time ago, and it's called Orientation in Me, and it's what he calls a sexual autobiography. And in that, he goes through his life and tries to tie or make links between each stage and this developing fantasy life that eventually became developed to the murders. And there's a lot that is interesting in there. There's a lot also that's deceitful and lying. He's a constantly moving target for him when he looks back at his life, because he's always trying to find some way in which he's less, or part of him is less culpable. He as a person has to be, you know, somehow grander. And so now when he goes back to look at his grandfather, who he used to say was the most important figure in his life, he now says, I think he was a paedophile, and I think he might have done things to me, and I think that might have contributed. So we can't take everything he says at face value, but there's a lot in that part of the manuscript that is psychologically interesting, especially when you take it in its context and in conjunction with what we know elsewhere.
And in all your letters back and forward to him, he wanted to believe that he was a unique case. And you've spoken to many murderers who exhibit the same traits, so that couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah, I think it's not just murderers. I think quite a lot of, you know, he liked to call himself an ordinary man taken to an extraordinary conclusion. Mm. What he was more like was an ordinary sex criminal taken by, you know, circumstances and events to an extraordinary conclusion. In my experience, it's, you know, a lot of sex criminals, paedophiles and rapists live a lot in the imagination. Mm-hmm. That's how they develop these ideas that they later enact. And they're quite intelligent and they're quite well-read and they've got, you know, active minds. And they are also people who compartmentalize a great deal. That if you meet them and they're not interested in you in that regard, they can seem charming and witty and intelligent and erudite and all of that, which, you know, Nielsen certainly could. But if you find them in a motel room and you know, under the wrong circumstances, you see a completely, you know, grotesquely different individual.
And yet, there's almost a kind of mystique about him, and hundreds of fans, almost men and women, were almost attracted to what he was and would overlook what he'd done.
I think they were attracted to this image, this almost a mythology that developed around him, and that was partly because when it happened, we had Sutcliffe, but serial killers were largely known through American movies, and he seemed to match that. And then his grandiosity and the way he spoke about himself seemed to chime with that image. But there was also the fact that there was a biography written about Nielsen in 1985, where the author had visited him from the time that he was arrested right through to, well, up until the 90s. And Nielsen had written very extensively about himself in that, and these prison journals were used in the book. And when edited down, I mean, a lot of what, if you read Nielsen, read him at length, it's very dense and boring. But he can have a kind of a way with words, and he plagiarizes quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And so edited down, his words made some people feel that he was some kind of, you know, tortured soul gone wrong, or a kind of Dostoevsky crime and punishment figure, you know, taken in a real life in a different context. And that just wasn't, you know, that wasn't who he was, but that was the person that these hundreds of people felt that they were writing to.
In the end, Russ, with all you know about him and all you've written about him, do you have any sympathy at all for him?
Well, it's difficult to, I mean, you know, when you speak to somebody and you correspond with them, there will be elements of their character that anybody will feel some sort of, you know, connection with. Yeah. If somebody's writing to you and it's towards the end of their life, then, you know, you're not human unless you feel something, because this is another living person. But, you know, do I feel that there's anything redeemable about his crimes through his psychology? I mean, I think fundamentally what you say sort of boils down to, you know, do I feel whether that he should have been convicted as a diminished? And no, I think he was somebody who was, his moral and psychological defects were both very much present. But I think his moral defects outweighed it. Was he mad or bad? Well, he was both.
Yeah.
But he was more bad. Was he playing from a full deck? Not completely. Did he know what he was doing? Did he plan those things? Did he enact his fantasies? Yes, he did. As such, you know, he was a very wicked man.
Absolutely. Well, you've written about him, and people can get hold of that if they want to find out a bit more. Russ, it's been really interesting to talk to you today. Thank you ever so much for your time. I know you're a busy man.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Russ. Cheers. Bye-bye.